Welcome back to the Soundtracker podcast. I'm your host, Eric Peacock. So I apologize if there's any weird background noise in this introduction. I usually record in the same room that I have my air conditioner in. Not usually, always. And I turn it off whenever I record, but it is 100 degrees outside. I have put two really long days in a row in out in this 100 degree heat. I am keeping it on while I record this introduction. I'm keeping it short anyway, so I guess it really doesn't matter. If you are not following along with the show, if you're new to the show, you can follow along over on Twitter at Soundtracker with an underscore at the end. I talk about the show a lot over there, or on my own personal account on Twitter, which is UWEBOLLOCKS. If you're new to the show, thanks for listening. If you're not, as always, thanks for joining in. If you have not yet, give the show a rating wherever you listen, Apple, Spotify, whatever you listen to, give the show a rating if you like it, because every little one helps. And then finally, one other thing that helps with this show is I'm going to talk about the Patreon again. Started a Patreon a few weeks ago where you get bonus episodes. You can do one that's just sort of a tip jar thing. It gets you a few bonuses as well. You can find that over on www.patreon.com/soundtracker. And please check it out, because that's what's going to help keep this show going, is support from listeners. So check it out if you have not yet. Hopefully you can find a plan that works for you, but like I said, those things are going to help keep the show going, and you're going to get extra stuff with it. Two bonus episodes a month at one tier, two bonus episodes a month, plus an extra mini series that I do down the road at another tier. And for the lowest tier, it's basically just saying you like the show, here's a tip every month, and you get a few bonuses for that as well. Okay, I think I've said enough. I'm going to let you listen to the episode. I think you're going to enjoy it. So I Married an Axe Murderer, coming up.
No use running, ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original songs, the soundtrack are gonna track you down!
All right, everyone, welcome back. So today I'm joined by Twitch streamer, podcaster, and beloved Twitter personality, Rob Rousseau. Rob, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Thanks for the invite. Well, right?
Yeah, that's great. That's working for me. Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so let me ask you, when I first said something about the show, you had asked, is anybody doing So I Married an Axe Murderer?
This is yeah.
A while back. So of all of the soundtracks, what was it about So I Married an Axe Murderer?
I think it's just because it's whenever it comes up, this kind of phenomenon of just random 90s movies having great soundtracks, this is just always the movie I go to. It's a very kind of out of nowhere random movie that probably now here in 2022, not a lot of people have even seen. and for me, I just think like this is a soundtrack that came along. Like this movie came out in 93, I guess. I probably saw it in 95. And, you know, I was about 12, 13 years old. And like it came out right at this sort of transition period for me where I'm kind of a preteen. It was one of the first like rock albums that I listened to that I had. And before I was listening to more like Weird Al and more stuff that's more geared towards kids and younger people. This is when I was kind of starting to become a young adult or whatever, a preteen. And so it just triggers this sort of nostalgia center in my brain when I think about this, because at that exact point in my life, this film and this soundtrack came along that I'll always kind of associate with that time period. And I'll always, again, whenever this question comes up of random films with fun soundtracks, it's always just the first thing I go to for that reason.
And that's great. And I'm 41. Are you 41 also? I'm used to being the old one on here.
I just turned 39.
Oh, shit. Okay. Well, you said 12, 13. I was like, hey, maybe I've got one that's... Well, okay. So my experience with this, so I'm going to be 100% honest. I had never listened to the soundtrack as a whole until we did this. I remember I remember There She Goes. Haven't seen the movie a bunch. I remember There She Goes being in it in multiple variations. You know, a couple of the songs, Saturday Night. But as a whole, I had never listened to the soundtrack. And it is a very, very of its time. It is very much a 1993 soundtrack. But I don't mean that in a bad way. And that makes sense, too. It's like, this being a good jumping point for like when you start to discover your own music, this is the kind of stuff that they played on. Not 120 minutes. 120 minutes was more alt than this, I guess. But MTV had another show that was like Alt Nation or something like that. I might be making that name up, but it played these sort of buzz bands. They were called buzz bands. And like Soul Asylum, I remember Somebody to Shove by Soul Asylum was one of them. And so, yeah, I could see this having been at like a formative age, something that like when you're starting to branch out, because I like you, I listened to like Weird Al and then like started to branch out into my own sort of things that wasn't what my parents listened to and wasn't like Weird Al or something like that. And yeah, but this is a good one. So thanks for choosing this. And it also, which we'll talk about this more when we get to the movie discussion, this got me to revisit this movie, which I haven't seen in a long time. And I can place a time, not the exact year, but kind of how long it's been once we talk about the movie. But so, you know, this is a movie that I was glad to come back to, because this was one, you know, when it came out, as I'll mention here, it did not do very well at the box office, but it went on to become a cult hit. And I remember like friends of mine quoting Heat and, you know,
yeah.
So it's one of those movies that among a certain generation, because like you said, there's probably a lot of people that have never even seen this now, but I feel like among like older millennials or like Gen X in general, like this is a pretty beloved movie. And it's interesting to go back to it in 2022 and the soundtrack as well. So
yeah,
good choice.
Yeah. Like I was saying in the pre-show, I'm sure, I don't think I've seen this movie in at least 15, 20 years, but I saw it so many times in the 90s that the entire thing is just permanently burned onto my, burned into my memory. So it's not going to be a problem for me to discuss the film.
All right. Well, just to give some background. So this movie debuted on July 30th, 1993 theatrically, and it had a few like one-off shows. There was like a benefit show, and then it had its like red carpet premieres like within the few days prior to that, but it's like theatrical debut was July 30th. And the reviews at the time were lukewarm at best. It debuted, and this is the first time I've had this with one of these, it didn't debut in the top 10. It debuted at number 12. With a $3.4 million opening weekend, and it only went on to make $11 million against a budget of $20 million. Okay. However, as I said earlier, the time since, it's gone on to develop a pretty big cult following. Now, the top 10, the week that it was released, this is a pretty solid top 10 list. Number one is Rising Sun. Number two is In the Line of Fire, which has had a lot of discussion on Twitter lately. I've seen people talking about In the Line of Fire for some reason. I don't know if it's one of those like pick four movies, one has to go something or one of those things. But I've seen a lot of talk about that one recently. Number three is The Firm. Number four is Free Willy. Number five is Jurassic Park. Number six was Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
And that was probably after about 6 months of Jurassic Park being in theaters.
Yes.
Still, yeah.
And in fact, I think the only other new opening in the top 10 that weekend was Robin Hood, Men in Tights, which is another one that, you know, opened at sixth place, but it has gone on to become a pretty beloved cult film over the years.
Yeah.
Number seven was Poetic Justice. Number eight was Sleepless in Seattle. Number nine was Coneheads, which I actually just watched like 2 weeks ago for the first time in a really long time.
Yeah. I would definitely give that a rewatch.
Okay. So here's what amazed me about Coneheads watching it. That's one that I want to cover on here, because first of all, Coneheads has what would be maybe the best Chili Pepper song exclusive to that soundtrack, and that's Soul to Squeeze. That song was on that soundtrack and nowhere else. But the whole time I watched Coneheads, it was literally like a, holy shit, he's in this or she's in this. Like every 5 minutes, like somebody popped up that I was like, no way. Like, I don't remember them being in
this. Well, it's that SNL connection too, right? Because this movie is the same. There's so many great cameos in So I Married an Axe Murderer. It's one of the main things that makes it really, the comedy of it still work, because there's so many hilarious cameos.
Charles Grodin just kills in this movie. And
he steals the whole last part of the movie in like 30 seconds of screen time. It's incredible.
And then rounding out that top 10 was another stakeout. So the big news that day,
that was on this, Rosie O'Donnell.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She was in the sequel. Yeah. I have not seen another stakeout in years, but the first stakeout is a pretty fun movie. I remember the sequel even 1993 when it came out. I think that's probably the only time I've seen it. I remember even then being like, this isn't very good.
Yeah. I probably caught it on HBO in like 95 one time.
So the big news of the day, and again, slow news day, but actually this is fucked up, but it was like the one thing I could find. Don Meerick, the saxophonist for Earth, Wind & Fire, who worked with Phil Collins and others too, was killed in a narcotics investigation by police when they came into his home to serve him a warrant, and they mistook a butane lighter in his hand for a gun. So that was 30 years ago, and things have not changed a bit. So a few little pieces of background on the movie. Sharon Stone was initially set to play the role of Harriet, but she also wanted to perform a dual role and play Rosie Michaels. And the studio denied her request, and they just took her out of the movie altogether. When the characters did the first cast read through of the film, Charlie's father, Stuart, had not been cast yet. And so Mike Myers read the character's lines and the filmmakers enjoyed his interpretation so much that they realized he could play that role just as well. Now, to me, that feels like it could be a harbinger of what eventually sort of derailed Mike Myers' career. Like that moment could be the thing that, you know, playing multiple characters and, yeah, you know, just on a whim in this. But we'll get to that. So the male lead was originally written for Chevy Chase. Woody Allen was also considered for playing Charlie, and Albert Brooks and Martin Short also considered the role, but did not like the character when they read the script.
Okay.
When they were doing the scene in the butcher shop, Nancy Travis was distracted by Mike Myers and she accidentally cut off the tip of her middle finger on her left hand when chopping. Yeah, she literally, and so she was yelling, cut, 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 which she meant literally, like she cut herself. And the crew thought that she was like, you know, she wants to cut the scene. She wants to stop the scene. So they sewed it back on. But in the movie, if you notice, there's a part where Harriet takes the wedding rings out of talcum powder. You can see a bandage on the middle finger of her left hand from where she had chopped the tip of her left finger off earlier in the shoot. Yeah. So the film's French title was When Harriet Axes Charlie, which is like a play on When Harriet Met Sally. But Mike Myers, this now, okay. So there's a whole thing about Mike Myers in general that he's difficult to work with. It's been one of those like things that's kind of followed him around. And it started on this movie. There was a rumor that he was difficult. Now, from what I hear, there's multiple stories here, but if the story that Mike Myers tells is true, then he kind of got thrown under the bus because he and Neil Mullarkey, an old friend of his from Britain, they changed the story and rewrote a bunch of comedy in the script, the original screenplay, which was written by Robbie Fox. Robbie Fox was asked to consider a new set of credits that gave story by and a co-screenplay credit to Neil Mullarkey. He rejected the proposal and the Writers Guild decided Fox would receive the sole screenwriting credit. So he kind of fucks with people around there, but it kind of became this thing that Mike Myers is difficult. Now, the director, Thomas Schlamm, has said that he did have differences with Mike Myers over how the film should be shaped, but you know, that he was taking a stretch beyond his usual self and was playing outside of himself. So personality clashes were going to happen. And just to be clear, the screenwriter for this, his only credits beyond this are In the Army Now and then a bunch of shit you never heard of. I saw one called Granddaddy Daycare. So yeah. The Dunsmuir Mansion, which is where a lot of this was filmed, the rooftop scene was actually a replica. So that whole scene on the rooftop was just a 16,000 foot replica that they actually donated to the foundation were later used in the mansion's renovation.
Okay. That's the whole like ending sequence. Like when they actually get married.
Yes. When he and Rose are fighting on the rooftop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then one final one, there's just a little connection to another film. The maroon Volkswagen that he drives in the film was the same one that was driven by Robert Redford in Sneakers because they were both filmed in San Francisco. Yeah. And the film that Dunsmuir Estate,
Sneakers.
I know it's a great movie. It's someone asked me about that one too. They're like, does it have a soundtrack? But I don't think it did. If I remember,
it's got
correctly.
A great original score though.
Yes. It just not a soundtrack. Now,
yeah.
Who knows? I've done enough electronic stuff where I said I wouldn't do scores, but I've done enough stuff at this point. That's kind of like, I mean, it's basically a score that maybe I will venture out and do some things like that, but we'll see. But the Dunsmuir Estate where that whole ending sequence is filmed was actually where the movie Phantasm was filmed, which I love Phantasm. And I had never made that connection before, but that's another movie tie-in with this one. So let's talk about the movie. And the first thing we've got to talk about is Mike Myers. And there was a time where he was like the coolest, funniest guy. Cool might not be the right word, but he was like the funniest guy around.
I thought he was cool as hell. I mean, the early 90s is like, cause I would, you know, I came to this movie because I was really getting into that sort of like that SNL cast with Myers and Farley and Dana Carvey and John Lovitz and Dennis Miller and Kevin Nealon and that whole crew. And you know, I like any other pre-teenaged boy in the early 90s, I loved Wayne's World. So I thought he was the coolest guy ever. And that's, I think, just to speak to something you were mentioning too, about the him being difficult to work with. I actually think like the first I ever heard of that was Wayne's World and the way that, and again, I think Myers was kind of vindicated in this as well, because the studio really wanted in the musical sequence in Wayne's World where they did Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, that famous classic iconic sequence in Wayne's World. The film studio wanted that to be Guns N' Roses. And Myers just said like, no, like he put his foot down and refused to, he was like, no, we're not making the movie if we're changing this, and was proven right. I mean, that was like a ended up being an iconic sequence in the film, and it was one of the most popular moments in the film. But yeah, that's just to your point. I absolutely thought Mike Myers when I saw this movie, I guess for the first time in probably 1995. I definitely did think he was the coolest guy for sure.
Oh, and I mean, I still love the first Wayne's World. It is a very funny movie. It is a very funny movie. And, you know, and then you had Austin Powers, and I still love the first. I have not watched this movie since before The Love Guru came out, because that was when things kind of.
Yeah.
And it even painted my viewing of this movie, you know, and I feel like Mike Myers, like his fall was hard and not necessarily deserved. I mean, you're a comedian, but I think with him, it comes down to two things. He had, you know, two bombs in a row with Cat in the Hat and Love Guru. But the problem is, I feel like his shtick of guy doing weird voices wore very thin with people, and it became not cool to like him. Now, you can also point to somebody like Adam Sandler, where that same thing happened with Adam Sandler, and Sandler just kind of powered through it, and it came circled back around to where people absolutely love Adam Sandler again, you know, like he, but Sandler.
Well, he also had some dramatic chops that he was able to use in different kind of more interesting dramatic films like Punch Drunk Love. And that's not something that Myers was ever really given an option to. I don't know if he would be able to do it, but that's one big difference, right? Is that Sanders was able to kind of like expand beyond that scope of the wacky sort of former SNL guy doing weird characters and, you know, kind of lowbrow stuff, which I love, like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore, but expanding his horizons a little bit. And Myers was just never had that opportunity to the same extent.
I agree with you. I mean, look, Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison, Waterboy, like I love all that. But then it came like, you know, Little Nicky was like his first. That was Sandler's first miss. Little Nicky was basically Adam Sandler's Love Guru, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like when Love Guru came out and everyone hated it, and then Cat in the Hat and everyone hated it, Mike Myers kind of retreated. I don't feel like he was too toxic to work with, because I'm sure that people look. Mike Myers is a funny guy, and he could still be a box office draw. And I feel like it wasn't a matter of like people stopped offering him roles as much as he was licking his wounds, you know, and Sandler just kind of said, I'm going to keep making shit. And then it did, like you said, it gave him that opportunity where people were like, I'm going to take a chance on this guy. And he got these dramatic roles. Mike Myers got that to an extent after having not worked in years with his role in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And
while also doing a wacky character and, accent and being covered in a bunch of makeup.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But it really is interesting, because I was on that train after like Love Guru and Cat in the Hat. I was like, Mike Myers sucks. You know what I mean? But I was at that perfect age I was very cynical at the time.
Yeah.
And so I have not watched either Austin Powers movie. I watched Wayne's World in that time. I love Wayne's World. I've seen that enough, but like, the ones where he's doing the shtick, like his wacky characters, wacky voice movies, and multiple characters.
Yeah.
I have not watched any of those since Love Guru or Cat. Well, I never saw Cat in the Hat or Love Guru. But
I didn't actually see Love Guru either. It just looked too painful to me.
Yeah. I mean, it looked like a piece of shit just from the trailers. Like you could tell looking at it that this was going to be a terrible movie. So watching this movie, I feel like the parts where Mike Myers is at his best is when he's playing the character straight. When he tries to be zany,
yeah,
it gets a little like I told you before we recorded. If I had to hear him say hello one more time, I was gonna like shut the movie off.
I thought it was very cool in 1995, but I'm not sure I would find it so funny now.
and I hate saying this. I don't want to beat up on the guy, because he is very important to some formative years of my life as far as comedy goes, and I feel like Mike Myers probably still has some great shit in him. And probably has over these, whatever, two decades that he's basically retreated from the spotlight and just kind of sat with his money and not done anything. But I also would be lying if I said that all of this, even 20 years later, isn't still sort of changing how I look at something like So I Married an Ex-Murderer. Now, with that said, I don't want to sound like I'm saying So I Married an Ex-Murderer is bad, because it's not. I still enjoyed it just as much as I always have going back to it after all of these years. It's a very funny movie. It is a very charming movie. It's just when Mike Myers is doing his Mike Myers thing that it's like, oh shit.
Yeah. Although, I mean, that's the thing. It's like his whole dual role playing his father at the same time as that kind of like cartoonish Scottish caricature. That's what gets some of the biggest laughs in the whole movie. So you kind of live with the Myers and die by the Myers in this film. because that's bringing a lot of the biggest jokes and the biggest laughs and the most iconic moments that people remember are all the Scottish dad screaming at his son with the big head. You know, that's what everyone remembers from this movie.
Well, and that's the thing. Stuart is the funniest character in the whole movie. So, like, yeah. It works there. It works tremendously there because it is a very inspired character. Like, that part in the movie where he's talking shit about Colonel Sanders and Anthony LaPaglia, that's a real laugh. Like, they just kept it in the movie. Yeah. He was genuinely laughing at him when he was going off about that. speaking of Anthony LaPaglia, he is very good in this movie.
Yep.
I forgot how much I like Tony as a friend of his, and his whole thing with wanting to be like a TV cop. He
wants his boss to be screaming at him and getting him chewing him out and stuff.
Alan Arkin, uncredited. Alan Arkin,
yeah.
He's uncredited for this movie. He didn't put his name to the credits. Well, I guess we can talk about...
Somebody needs a hug.
When he comes out, he's yelling a bunch of Italian slurs, and he's like, not now. And he's like, what, was there too many slurs in that one? But the supporting characters and the cameos in this, Alan Arkin, Charles Grodin, Phil Hartman, Stephen Wright. And then when you get to this lesser end, you got Michael Richards, who's very funny in his part in this, but hilarious. I couldn't help but think when he storms out yelling, it is exactly the same mannerisms that he had on the Laugh Factory stage as he's like having that meltdown.
Less funny then, in that circumstance.
And then Carrot Top, who looks very different because they have his hair like kind of pulled up into it's much shorter in this movie. But I had forgotten about. Yeah, I had to pause because I was like, is that Carrot Top? It looks like Carrot Top. But right from the jump in this movie, though, obviously we talk about the song more with the soundtrack, but you've got There She Goes, two different versions of it, of the three that I know of. You got two versions, the Boo Radleys, which is a tremendous opener. And it's a great through line for this movie as a song because they revisit it quite a few times.
Yeah.
But that opening credit sequence, I realized as I was watching it that this is such a very early 90s looking movie that opening credit sequence where it's like moving through the coffee house and like the look of the people there, the sort of like look of the film itself, the music playing, the styles, it's almost like a time capsule, that opening sequence where it's just like, this is a 1993, you know, young Gen Xer coffee house.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that so much of the narrative of this film and the whole character is based around this idea of like coffee shop beat poetry is so 90s in and of itself. It's never really explained whether he has another like career or he has another income stream. Like, it's basically suggested that he earns a pretty decent living as this kind of beat poet in these random coffee shops. Like you said, he's driving around this beautiful convertible that Robert Redford was driving in sneakers, lives in a nice place. And I guess he shows up a couple times a week at the coffee shop and does some poetry readings. And that seems to be it.
Yeah. You know what? Now that you say that, they never show him doing I've got a job. I hadn't considered that until just now.
My understanding watching this film is that his job was like a beat poet, and that was his whole career. And that's how he financed his whole lifestyle. That's the end of history. You were able to do that kind of thing in the Clinton years. It was still possible, but in Biden's America, now we can know. Poets are being held back.
You get paid enough doing one beat poem to put 1 gallon of gas in your car these days. So watching this last night, one thing, and this is not Mike Myers' fault, I can understand why, I can't remember, it wasn't Woody Allen, but going back, I have to go back in my notes, but whichever actors I said read the script and did not like the Charlie character, I can understand that because at the end of the day, Charlie's a piece of shit. He's a paranoid guy who looks out for everything he can find wrong because like it's supposed to be fear of commitment, but like some of his shit's just like mean-spirited, like she smelled like soup. And like the part where he dumps Harriet, like he's such a fucking asshole throughout so much of this movie that actually the fact that you know kind of root for him to succeed is 100% grounded in Mike Myers, to give him a compliment.
I think that's a good point. It's his kind of charisma that allows you to stick with him as a protagonist while he's treating everyone like shit. And he's very, very arrogant and selfish in the way it is a very Gen X movie.
I had never noticed that before. Maybe it's watching it now at 41 as opposed to, like I said, probably 20 something the last time I saw this. And it hit me. I'm like, Charlie's not like a good person. Like, why am I rooting for this guy? And it 100% comes down to Mike Myers' sort of boyish charm that he had. And you know, he looked like a Mike Myers. I think it's the haircut, but Mike Myers always looked like a really big 12-year-old.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said, I like it better when he plays it straight, because I do feel like when it gets into Harriet and his romance, even though it's sort of done through that very 90s montage sequence where I forget what song it is it's playing from the soundtrack over it, but like you see their relationship developing over an unspecified amount of time. But it's
it's a thing. If I remember correctly, it's Rush New York City Club Mix by Big Audio Dynamite 2 is the song.
That is right. I usually put that in my notes, and I realized as I was looking at it that I forgot to put that. But I think that the romance works well. Now, one thing and this comes down to, again, Amanda Plummer being tremendous in this movie. Amanda Plummer's great in everything, but I feel like unless you are not remotely paying attention, you pretty much know right away that Rose is the one that has been killing people.
Yeah.
And not Harriet. Although I do think they do a good job swerving you a little bit in the final act that maybe it is Rose, you know, like maybe Rose is actually a killer, because she plays that character in a way that makes you think, you know, maybe she is. Like the scene at their wedding, which I love the wedding sequence too, that extremely Scottish wedding and Stuart yelling, "Let's get pissed." But when she's singing "Only You," they manage to take like what should be a pretty moment and make it genuinely somewhat unsettling as she's singing it. And he's like realizing that maybe she is not who he thought she was.
Yeah. Great moment. It's Nancy Travis, right?
Nancy Travis
plays it beautifully. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I was looking at what else she's been in since this came out, and she was in that Tim Allen Last Man Standing or whatever it was series. She plays his wife in that, which
I missed that one.
Yeah, I mean, I had to look it up on IMDb. The main thing
I remember her from besides this is the film The Vanishing, the Kiefer Sutherland and Jeff Bridges kind of thriller,
the super inferior remake to the original. Yeah, that's, and I'm not like, it's just a bad remake. They changed the ending up. The same director. It's a really, that, not to get too off topic, but that is one of the weirdest Hollywood things ever, because the same director of The Vanishing came and remade his own film for American audiences with American, you know, with English language, and then fucked up the thing that everyone liked about The Vanishing, which was the ending.
Yeah. Those test audiences, the Yankee test audiences just wouldn't let him do it.
It almost feels like a fuck you though. Like you Yanks want me to come over and you can't read subtitles. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to give you a shitty version of this movie. But let's talk about Stuart. So Stuart as the father. Okay. Stuart doesn't have to say a word and he's very funny. Like those ridiculous glasses. Like Mike Myers just looks funny in that character.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite lines, like right away, Stuart has one of my favorite lines in the movie, and it's "Give your mother a kiss or I'll kick your teeth in."
Yeah. Well, it feels authentic. It feels authentic as cartoonish as he is and as ridiculous as he is in many ways. They do kind of they're able to take this kind of ridiculous character and ground it in a way that it does feel there. It feels like it lived in a little bit, the whole family situation in this.
Oh, by the way, did you notice that his mom, and I had somehow never put this together, his mom is the pigeon lady in Home Alone 2.
Yeah, I'm just realizing that now that I'm realizing, because I just watched Home Alone 2 like 3 days ago. So now, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, wait, how do I know her? Because she looks not different. That's another thing too about this movie that places it very firmly in the 90s, is that his mom just chiefs cigarettes in the house, which is not something that you see characters do in movies anymore unless they're like a villain.
Yeah. I've been smoking in general. That's a funny trend in a lot of like family comedies in the 80s and 90s. How many characters are just blasting cigs the entire time?
Everyone used to it. You see sequences in like hospitals and shit where people are smoking.
Yeah, exactly.
Things were wild back then.
Yeah.
So I didn't know this. This is actually something before I watched the movie, the Alex that does the logo for the show, he and I were talking on the phone about something, and you having not seen the movie recently. So something that there's a scene where Stuart is talking to Anthony LaPaglia and he's talking about the Pentaveret.
Yeah.
Which is that show that he has on now.
Yeah,
on
yeah, that's,
Netflix.
That's the funny thing that ties it together with right now. And talking about the years of Myers not really doing all that much, and now he's doing this show called The Pentaveret, which is based on basically a joke from this movie.
Yeah, I have not watched it yet. Have you?
No, it looks really bad, though. I have no interest in watching it. I think this joke about The Pentaveret is probably a lot funnier in a 45-second joke in this throwaway gag in this 1993 romantic comedy than a fully like $100 million Netflix production with Mike Myers. You want to, you like Mike Myers in weird costumes? Well, guess what, buddy? You're going to get a whole bunch of that. We got about 8 different characters that he's doing in this one.
Something that people haven't enjoyed in 20 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's give him more of that.
Stewart's dunks on Heed are some of the funniest things in the world, though. Like, I still, it looks like an orange on a toothpick is like one of my favorite insults of all time.
Like, yeah. It's like Sputnik, spherical, but quite pointy at parts.
You do a good Scottish accent. I can't do one. I would embarrass myself.
Well, I'm part Scottish. I have Scottish ancestry, so it's in my DNA to be able to do this, to be able to do the accent.
I do. Okay, so some of Charlie's smarminess, there are parts where, again, when he's not like over the topping it, some of his, even though he's kind of a prick about it, like, I love his joke when he walks into Harriet's apartment and he says, you know what this place needs? An oversized poster of Atlantic City. Like, that's a very, very funny joke.
Oh, you got one. Yeah.
Yeah. So Phil Hartman's little cameo is now
one of the funniest things, probably the funniest moment in the whole movie, I would say. Unbelievable.
He just deadpan tells that story about Machine Gun Kelly and how they came and urinated into his bitch's eye socket. Such, like, of all the stories to tell people walking through Alcatraz.
And at one point they start like laughing about it and he just gives him this like stern look. Fuck, it's wonderful. Yeah. And a makeshift knife or shiv.
God, I miss Phil Hartman. I wish that
I know. Oh, yeah.
I had actually forgotten completely that Phil Hartman was in this. So seeing him pop up was really nice to see because, you know,
yeah,
there's not a lot of stuff with Phil Hartman, unfortunately.
I know. I mean, I remember in the 90s when it was Farley and Phil Hartman died in a really short span of time. And of course I was a big Farley fan as well. So I was, that was very tragic as well, but with Farley, you could kind of see it coming in a way. Like, it was very clear that he was kind of living a kind of dangerous lifestyle. Whereas Hartman, it just came so out of nowhere and was such a, it was such a fixture on The Simpsons and all these really important kind of comedic institutions. And it was just, yeah, just the way that his death just kind of, was so shocking and surprising that I was more sort of traumatized by his death just because of the how out of nowhere it was.
It's funny because I actually remember both of them where I was when I found out they died. Phil Hartman, I was on my way to my little brother's Little League baseball game. I was literally leaving and it popped on the TV and I was like bummed as shit. And Farley was on our way to a wrestling meet. I learned that Chris Farley died by walking onto the bus and this one extreme shithead that like a couple years younger than me at my high school said, "Hey, fat dude from Saturday Night Live died." I was like, oh fuck. Like, yeah. Chris Farley died? Like, of all of like the most boorish possible way I could have learned that like the person that I thought was like the funniest person in the entire world had passed away. But yeah, I
gave him a good side headlock after.
He was like 115 pounds. It was we were like totally different weight classes, but yeah, I mean, I could have snuck something in at practice, just not at the meet.
Yeah.
The movie does a good job at, like I said, even though you know that Amanda Plummer, if you're paying even the smallest bit of attention, you're like, she's the killer. But they do a good job at doing the beats that you'd find in a normal, like almost like horror film when like he's afraid that Harriet's Mrs. X. And speaking of dated scenes, the scene where he's using a Thighmaster at the very beginning, which places it so firmly in 1993. Yeah. But where she backs him into that closet where she's trying to give him the hell shake and he's convinced she's trying to poison him. And then this,
all the stuff falls on him.
Yeah. Otherworldly amount of stuff that could not fit in that closet, like fills the entire thing up. But, and like his little line to her when she's talking about like, have you ever been next to someone and you're on the subway and you just think about shoving them? And he's like, usually I follow the Judeo-Christian ethic of thou shalt not kill. Like again, though, it's when he's playing it straight and he's not over the top. But
yeah.
But then like I said, you get to his really terrible breakup, which like it sucks. It sucks. And then he does those poems with his ex's pictures in the background. Like, what a fucking asshole.
Yeah, seriously.
But yeah, the end of the final act, I like the way they get married when they're at the anniversary, and the anniversary party for his parents is genuinely sweet too. When he talks about how much he loves her, like there are some, like I said, this movie manages to hit some genuinely sweet moments for being like a really absurdist sort of dark comedy. But when he asks her to marry him and she's like, no, and he's like, please, is a very funny line too, that like, she doesn't want him to be another one of, because you don't know at that point that all of her men, quote unquote, leave after they get married or once they're engaged because of Rose killing them. But like I said, they do a great job at that. Then you get the wedding sequence where she sings the song, and that shot, that Dormir Estate is a really great place for that final sequence. And that really cool shot when they go on their honeymoon and there's that really ominous sky hanging over the place. Like I said, it does a good job at sort of making it seem like it's going to, it takes beats from horror movies and, you know, it does it very well. And it, that's probably why they use the place Phantasm was filmed in, because it's a creepy old mansion and great place to have that final fight between he and Rose. But Charles Grodin's part, though, let's talk Charles Grodin before we wrap this up. So I just love, because again, it's Tony thinks he's got his chance. I love that he like keeps calling it commandeering the vehicle. And he's like, no, he's like, yeah. No, it's, and he's, and when they're in the car together and he's tapping and he's like, this bothers you? And he's like, no, it's one of my favorite things.
It's one of my favorite things. Yeah. It's so great. I know. But,
so then you get to the rooftop sequence, which is actually that rooftop standoff. Watching it last night, I was pretty impressed at how well staged that was for a comedy. Like it managed to keep the little bits of action that are actually in this movie fairly tight. You know, you obviously have to suspend your disbelief a little bit that she misses him with the axe like 17 times while he's hanging from the roof by his hands, that she somehow manages to miss his fingers. But, you know, it ends the way it should. I'm glad that Rose doesn't get killed, because Rose is obviously like a fucked up, lonely woman. She doesn't deserve to fall off of the building. Just get the help that she needs. And, yeah. You know, and then his poetry about heartbreak at the end is about how much he's in love. So it the poetry as a through line works well too, because you get the happy poem that he has at the end. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I said, I haven't seen it in many years, but with this movie, it was weird. It was not only with the soundtrack, but I just became very obsessed with this movie like when it came out. So I watched it just so many fucking times that it is just permanently burden to my memory. But now I do really want to actually watch it again from this, having this conversation and thinking about it again.
Well, I'm hoping that's the effect that it has on anyone listening to it, that like, go check it out again if you've not watched it, because
very fun.
Yeah, it is. That's the thing about this, is it's a very fun movie. And for it's, I mean, if you had to classify it, it would be a dark comedy, but it never goes super dark. Like, you don't see anyone die. You just know that people have been murdered. But, you know, some dark comedies, like, there would be, you know, Tony or one of his friends, some supporting character would die at some point. But it doesn't go that route. It's mostly a movie about Charlie's neurosis, but they're finally the first time that he's correct about something. Just, you know, has it pinned on the wrong person. All right. Well, that's So I Married an Axe Murderer. We're going to talk about the soundtrack here in just a second. But real quick, before we get into the soundtrack, I do want to mention that there is a Patreon for the show now, which you can subscribe to over at www.patreon.com/soundtracker. So for as little as $3 a month, you get to know that you're helping keep this show going, and you get some bonus content as well. For $6 a month, you'll get 2 bonus episodes, which will be coming very shortly. And then following June, they will be on a bi-weekly schedule. So this month's are already set. We've got Transformers the movie, the 1980s one, not the Mark Wahlberg or Shia LaBeouf ones, and Tank Girl with Scott Benson, who's coming back, a fan favorite from Batman Forever. So you don't want to miss those. Get signed up. And like I said, this is entirely self-funded, so that helps keep this going. And I appreciate every one of you. Okay, let's talk about the soundtrack. So the soundtrack, just to give a little background on this one, it released on July 27th, 1993. I was actually surprised that this, I did not realize this would. I thought for sure, because again, back then you had to sell a fuckload of albums to even make the Billboard 200. And I've done plenty of soundtracks on this show that did not chart in the top 200. For big movies, obviously they almost always did, but So I Married an Axe Murderer did not do well at the box office. I was certain this was going to be one that did not chart, but it did. It placed number 148 in its first week. And the top 10, yeah, I honestly figured for sure this was going to be one of the ones that just never charted. Maybe sold decently, but, you know, again, like I said, you could not make the top 200 and probably still sell 100,000 copies of your album. But this one actually did. So couldn't get a sales figure or anything like that. Or there was no certification. So it definitely didn't sell like 500,000 or go gold or anything. But I'm sure it did well enough. The top 10, the weekend that it was released, was Cypress Hill's Black Sunday at number one, which I just recently went through a really big return to Cypress Hill stuff. And let me tell you, Black Sunday is a fucking great album, even in 2022. It holds up so well. Number two is the Sleepless in Seattle soundtrack. Number three is U2's Zeropa. Number four is Janet Jackson's Janet.
Okay.
Number five is Stone Temple Pilots' Core. Number six is Barbara Streisand's Back to Broadway.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. There's always one really oddball one in these lists. Number seven was UB40's Promises and Lies. Now, I did not look into this, but I will absolutely guarantee you that that was the album that had their cover of I Can't Help Falling in Love with You, which was like their real big 90s hit. Which, funnily enough, made my dad really mad when it came out that somebody had desecrated an Elvis song with a like white guy reggae light version of it. Yeah. When it first came out. Number eight was the Bodyguard soundtrack. Number nine was Rod Stewart's Unplugged, which has the full title Rod Stewart Unplugged, Ellipsis, and Seated. And then number 10 was Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream. So
okay, that Bodyguard soundtrack was monster.
Oh my God. It was, really weird memory with that, that the night that Whitney Houston passed away, I was at my retail job and I worked until 9 o'clock, and it was a fucking huge thing. Like as much as it sucks to say this, like Whitney Houston's death wasn't something that was like a huge surprise. It sucks. Yeah. She was fucking supremely talented. And, I'm not saying that in, sometimes people throw that in a dismissive way. I feel like you hear that like Amy Winehouse a lot, like not a surprise, but like, she had had her troubles over the years, and it was like, unfortunately, it happened. And on the way home from work, I got in the car and one of the local radio stations in her memory was playing I Will Always Love You. And that song hit different like the night that she died. It was like, fuck, because again, you can understand why that album was a monster. That song, her vocal performance in that, like, Whitney Houston was so talented, so talented.
Maybe quite possibly the best singer ever. You could really make that case.
Pound for pound, there's a strong argument to be made for that.
Yeah.
So further down the chart, and again, if you're new to the show, what I'm doing here is I'm going down the chart to make your either the top 10 or top 200. Like back in the day, you had to sell a ton of albums. And I feel like this puts this in perspective. So these are three albums further down the top 200 chart that never cracked the top 10. So at number 18, we had Honest Is Back to Fuck Up, which peaked at number 17. But Slam is huge, and that album never managed to make it into the top 10. Now, another crazy fact that I learned when looking this up is, and this blew my fucking mind, Dr. Dre's The Chronic never hit number one on the Billboard 200. It peaked at number three, which is just insane to me to think about, because I mean, that album was a culture shift, and like, it was such a huge thing, and it never. Yeah. So just to, again, put a point on how many albums you had to sell to hit number one, Dr. Dre's The Chronic never ever reached number one on the Billboard 200. So number 24 on the chart was the Menace to Society soundtrack, which peaked at number 11. It was the closest we had to coming into the top 10 in these three. And at number 115 was Tool's Undertow, which only peaked at number 50 on the charts. So unless otherwise noted going forward, all of these songs on here are soundtrack originals, which honestly, Rob, I was pretty surprised by, because I was 100% certain going into this that this was going to be songs that they had plucked from previous albums or something. But no, these, almost all of these were either B-sides that they said, here, take these and use them, or written for this movie. And that was just a really surprising thing.
Okay.
All right.
And so one of them, like the song in the film, is Saturday Night by Bay City Rollers, who are famously from Scotland, obviously, and they get referenced in the movie. And then the version for this soundtrack is like a cover version by Ned's Atomic Dustbin.
I don't want to get ahead of myself. I really like that cover a lot.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Yeah. All right. So number one is the Boo Radley's There She Goes, which is a cover of a song by The Laws, who show up on the soundtrack also. This was given another cover by Sixpence None the Richer, which was a really big hit for Sixpence None the Richer. Okay, so there's three versions of this song that I know of. The two covers, the thing about the covers is they never stray too far from the original song. Like, nobody puts their own flavor on it outside of minor differences. But I think, as opposed to being like lazy or something, that's a testament to just how good the original song is. Now,
yeah, I mean, it's as close to a perfect pop song as you can possibly write, I think, which is, I think, a reason that's exactly why it did get covered so many times and why no one wanted to mess with it too much. Cause it's like, you've got what you've got there is already pretty close to perfection. So you don't need to fiddle with it too much.
It's very funny you say that when we get to the last song. I'm in agreement with you, but it's just funny that you use the words perfect here. Yeah. But yeah, of the three, I think this one feels the most upbeat. Like the other two sort of play it. There's like a melancholy sort of flavor to both the original version and the Sixpence None the Richer version. But I think if I were ranking the three that I'm sure there are versions of that song that I don't know about that probably stray really far from it, but I've not heard them. So of the three that I know, I would probably rank this one at number three, but it's still very, very good. Like I really like this cover a lot. And the thing about this cover is it feels like the original, but it's just slightly updated for the early 90s, like production quality.
Yeah, exactly. It's got a bit more of that kind of distortion. It's a bit more of that sort of, later Britpop kind of early alternative vibe while still maintaining that sort of pop sound, but it's got a little bit more fuzz, a little bit more of an edge to it. But again, like you pointed out, not straying too far off the path that's there for them.
Well, and it's, again, you're working with such a strong template that it's pretty hard to fuck up like a song like this. I feel like, are you familiar with the Boo Radleys at all prior to this? Or I mean, since then, have you like dug into anything?
Not really. I was more just today when I was preparing for this chat, I looked into them a little. I was not really familiar with their catalog that much.
Yeah. They're kind of like that for me too. This album is full of bands that like I know of, but don't know much of, you know, like I know the name Boo Radleys, but I have never really listened to the Boo Radleys outside of this song, honestly. Like maybe there's one that I've heard and didn't realize it was them, but yeah, I was just curious. I didn't know if any of these songs were like a gateway into getting into any of these bands down the road for you. All right. So up next is Toad the Wet Sprocket's brother. Now I've talked about Toad the Wet Sprocket. I believe this is the third time on this show. And each time
I definitely
that I
only know them from this soundtrack. I mean, I definitely remember the name of the band and hearing it, but I'm predominantly familiar with them because of the soundtrack.
They have one song the one song of theirs that I like, and I'm kind of going exactly against what I'm about to say, but the one song of theirs that I know that I like is Walk on the Ocean, but I think it's the band name has always made it hard for me to I can't stomach these guys, but that's the thing. So I've talked about this band three times. This is the third time now. And each time it has been me saying how much I dislike this band immediately before saying how much I like the song that I'm talking about. So like, this is no different. Like, I really like this song. I really like this one. And like, I don't know if it's that maybe they brought their best for the soundtracks or maybe I've been wrong this whole time. I'll never admit that I've been wrong this whole time, but maybe I've been wrong this whole time, but yeah, I really like this one.
Yeah. It's really a song that like, if you wanted to put the year 1993 to like a sound, it really captures that exact sound in American alternative rock that was really dominant at that point.
Oh, it is an extremely early 90s alt rock song. But the thing is, that's not what I think about when I think of this band's name. Like I'm used to like, for some reason I'm blanking on the name of their real big hit, which I do not like. But Walk on the Ocean is like a very soft ballad. So like
the biggest one is All I Want.
Yeah. That's
according
to
YouTube Music.
That's it. I could not remember. Yes, I do not like that song. But honestly, now that I'm like thinking about my experience, because Mike Nice Mustard sent me a song of theirs in Twitter messages when we were talking about this soundtrack and how much I like this Toad the Wet Sprocket song. And he was like, you're wrong about them. And the song that he sent me was very good too. So maybe I need to go back and revisit them. Yeah. I don't know. There's like this whole running thing between me and one of my friends that I like the Gin Blossoms better and he likes Toad the Wet Sprocket better. And
okay. I would be more of a Gin Blossoms man myself. Yeah.
There's no question. There's no question.
Yeah,
it's an insane stance to take that Toad the Wet Sprocket was better than the Gin Blossoms.
Yeah. That's some contrarian type stuff.
I feel like that
in my
too.
Opinion.
Shockingly, Gin Blossoms have not come up on this show yet. That's one of those like a
that
40.
Is shocking.
Yeah, 40. This is my 43rd episode, and I don't know, 43 deep, and I've not talked about the Gin Blossoms outside of this very moment right here, as far as I remember, unless I'm forgetting something.
I'm actually shocked that the Gin Blossoms are not on this soundtrack. I mean, it seems like they would fit right in there for the sound, the overall sort of sound and theme of this record.
I thought about that as I was going through this soundtrack the first time I listened to it. I was like, this feels like the Gin Blossom should be on
it. It's true.
Maybe it predated. I'm trying to think when Hey Jealousy came out. This might have predated the Gin Blossom's time. I don't remember. Gin Blossom.
Yeah, I guess maybe that was closer to like 96, wasn't it?
I think by then they were established. I think, but I'm thinking like 94, 95 might have been Hey Jealousy. Okay. I might be wrong though. I mean, somebody probably Googling this right now, listening and like,
yeah, that's gonna, a great song.
Tweet at me about it and tell me how wrong I was. But Hey Jealousy. Okay, this gives me an opportunity to say this while I'm under. There are people who like Hey Jealousy sucks. I heard it too much when I was growing up. Whatever. Hey Jealousy is low key, like very secretly one of the saddest songs ever written, especially knowing the context of the band member who wrote it and like all the problems he had. And, you know, he was dead within a year or whatever of that song being a big hit. But when you look at the lyrics to that song,
did not realize that.
Yeah, he had. Yeah, I cannot think of his name off the top of my head. I did not know I was going to go off in the spiel during this, but he, all he wanted was a gold record. And when they got the gold record for the song, he had this really bad mental break and he like broke the gold record up and got really bad on drinking and they booted him from the band and he committed suicide like 2 weeks after he got out of the, they wanted him to get help. They wanted him to go to a place to get help. And yeah, he's that's the one horrible. Who wrote like, yeah, it is. And he's like the guy who wrote like all of their really great songs on that first album were co-written by him. And, yeah, it's just a fantastic song. And like, if you look at those lyrics and know like some of the shit that he was probably grappling with at the time that he was writing the song, like there are some lines in that song that hit pretty fucking hard. Like, yeah. So if you were one of those people who's like, oh, it's like a, you know, it's a pop song, I heard it too many times, like revisit it, please, because Hey Jealousy is a really wonderful song. Well, okay. Now that we've talked about Gin Blossoms. So up next is Soul Asylum's The Break. So I talked about Soul Asylum on the I Know What You Did Last Summer episode, which actually, now that I think about it, that was one of the times I talked about Toad the Wet Sprocket. But I said back then that Soul Asylum was very good. And it sucks that like their big thing is Runaway Train, because that's really not one of their best songs. But, you know, I love Somebody to Shove. And this song, I like this song a lot.
Yeah, I was never a huge fan in the 90s. The song definitely fits in on the soundtrack very nicely, though. Again, like it's a very like Soul Asylum is a very I really think of like 1993 when I think of Soul Asylum. So it's they fit in like really well on this album.
I mean, everything on this is so like early 90s, but like Soul Asylum, yeah, they were everywhere. Like I remember them playing Runaway Train at like an eighth grade dance.
Yeah.
Weird song to play at a junior high dance, but they Runaway Train playing, like, yeah, let's dance to this song about runaway children. But there's some great lines in this song. Lyrically, it's kind of hard to pin down. I had to look up the lyrics. It's hard to pin down exactly what this song's about, but I kind of like that it's almost seems like getting older, but then there's like almost a an obsessive sort of side to it about a woman or an ex. And there's a really great line. I've got bars on my window and lines on my face, which I really enjoyed as a lyric. It's like sort of, you know, somewhat obtuse, but it's a fun line as somebody who's also getting lines on my face at this point in my life.
Yeah.
Just no bars on that. But yeah, great song. Great song. Up next, we've got Chris Whitley's Starve to Death. So Chris Whitley was a super duper talented guitarist, like extremely talented. Another sad story. He died at like 45 of lung cancer. But this was one actually listening to the soundtrack that was, because again, I had never listened to this soundtrack whole until I did it for the show. And this is one that over the handful of times that I listened to it leading up to this really grew on me. I don't love it. It's not going to be one of my favorites, but like it was one of those ones that I was like, I probably skipped this one when I listened to it on repeat listens. And it did grow on me. And I think the only problem with this one is, okay, you know, the guitar works great, but it's sort of this like bluesy dirge following a bunch of like peppy alt rock. And
yeah,
its placement is sort of strange in the album following up those three songs.
Yeah. And I got to be honest, when I went to re-listen to this on YouTube Music, the soundtrack, that one is not available, I guess, possibly for copyright reasons. So I wasn't able to revisit this one. This is the only one I didn't get a chance to listen to prior to this.
Oh, really? Okay. So YouTube Music must be different, because on Spotify, there's like six songs on this soundtrack that are not on Spotify. So that's interesting because I've been kind of running under the impression that all streaming services kind of had the same things due to, as you said, copyright stuff. But not the case because, yeah, there's only like six songs from this soundtrack on Spotify. But I'll be honest with you, not hearing it, you're not missing much.
Not missing much.
And I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't mean that like it's not good. It's just you could live without this one.
Yeah.
Okay, so
okay, I feel next, okay about skipping this one then.
Yeah. Don't feel too bad. I mean, if you really want to be a completionist, I'm sure you could find it on like YouTube, the app, not the music app, but like YouTube in general. But you don't really need to take the time to do that. So number five, we've got Big Audio Dynamite 2's right. Rush.
This is the montage song.
Yes. So this originally appeared on their album, The Globe. However, this mix is original to the soundtrack. Now
it's kind of got a little early house kind of a vibe to it.
It's such an early 90s remix. Like, God damn, is this an early 90s remix? That early Absolutely. 90s it keeps a club, that early 90s club sound in the background. Yeah, you nailed it. That was like my next note was how early 90s of a remix this was. Now, did you know that Mick Jones of The Clash was in this band?
I did not know that, no.
Yes, this was Mick Jones as one of his bands. They actually, I didn't know much about them. So this might be what they always sound like. So if that shitty, because they, I know they, and I looked them up on Wikipedia. They like, I found out the Mick Jones thing, but you know, it had like, they dabbled in like six different genres and one of them was like house or dance. And so maybe this is normal for them, but it is a very early 90s sort of dance music. But the thing is, it's not, again, it's not bad. The problem is, if it weren't for the next song we're going to talk about, it would be my pick for, I'm skipping this one if I have just enough time to listen to the album, except there's not quite enough time for the whole runtime. I've got to skip one song. This would be the one.
I would be interested in hearing this, the non-remix version of this song, which, because I feel like there's some decent melodies and some decent grooves in there. But again, it's really overpowered by this very overwhelming early 90s remix. Early dance music kind of vibe, which takes it in this different direction. I'd be interested to at least see what the original track sounded like.
And you know, it's weird because I usually do that for this show and I just did not get around to it for that song. Anytime it's like a song that's been oft covered, like there's plenty of songs that, you know, were famous and were literally written, like they've been covered for, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but one that I did in the show where it was like, there were literally like four covers of it. And like the original one was like, an old like black blues musician, you know, like that's the original version. And like, now you're listening to it through like an 80s pop star. And like the famous version was like covered by some British rock band in the 70s. So like, I always try to go back and do like the lineage and see which one I like the most. And I should have done that with this. I didn't, but I have a feeling it probably sounds exactly the same minus the like really shitty early house.
You're probably right. Yeah.
Okay. So now we've got without question, what is the worst thing on this soundtrack for me? And that is Mike Myers, This Poem Sucks. I hate this. I hate this. And I hate that it's on here. Honestly, in 1998, I probably would have at least liked it slightly more, but it still would have been one that I skipped.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, the last two decades of Mike Myers hasn't helped it.
Yeah. So this was the one when he's getting Harriet back, right? If I remember correctly, that's the one.
Yeah, the very end.
Yeah.
Or not the very end. Yes. When he's like doing the like really hammy jazz hand stuff when he's trying to win her back. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
It didn't need to be on here. I understand why they did. I think the problem with it is the placement of it pisses me off so much because look, just put it at the end. Like if you want to throw like this fun little thing on here, put it at the fucking end, because here's the thing. After the first time I listened to this soundtrack, I skipped this every time. It was like, it came on and I'm like, God damn it. I got to get, and I'm, I listened to these things on an iPod, as I've said before on here. So I had to get this like old shitty iPod Touch that's almost dead out of my pocket as I'm out on my walk and change this song. And then I'm worried that it's going to like do that weird thing where it shakes in my pocket and shuffle songs. And like, it just pissed me off so much being right in the middle of it. Like it was.
Yeah. It's got some nice jazzy stylings in the background there.
I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. Like I said, had this been one that they placed at the, because again, it really is just like a bonus song. Like it's a fun wink to like people who listen to it did not need to take center stage on this fucking album.
As I was saying, like just the whole beat poetry angle to this film is just really funny in retrospect. It made sense to me when I was, you know, 12, 13 watching this. I was like, yeah, this is, not only is this like normal, but it's cool and good. And I like it. And then you think about it as an adult and you're just like, what was going on with that? Why did I like that? I don't know. Why did anyone like that? It's bizarre.
You know, thankfully though, I was a little worried that maybe the movie was not going, that was going to be like the whole movie for me, having not watched it in years. So like I said, thankfully the movie itself did not to go back to the movie, but like, thankfully the movie did not do that, nor did the soundtrack, because this is a very dated soundtrack in a lot of ways. But I mean, as you can tell by the way I'm talking about it, outside of the Mike Myers song, there's nothing on here that's like offensively bad. There's just a couple of like mediocre songs on it. And then the rest is quite good. So, all right. So up next is Ned's Atomic Dustbin Saturday Night, which is a cover of the Bay City Roller song. So, you know, as I've said on here often, covers can be very hit or miss with me. And I really like the Bay City Rollers version of this song.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
I really like it. It's so good. It's such a great song.
Yeah.
But this is a really great cover. This is one that goes for the, it swings for the fences. Like, it's very different from the original. And it, you know, you're taking a chance because it's a pretty beloved song. But to me anyways, I'm curious to see how you feel. But for me, I think it really works. And I like their choices to make it like a straight up rocker. This was like the most surprising one in the soundtrack for me. When I saw there was a Saturday Night cover by Ned's Atomic Dustbin, I was like, oh, fuck. But
yeah, no, I don't think it compares to the original. I also really love the Bay City Rollers track. And yeah, I listened to it again prior to this conversation. I was just like, while I listened to them back to back. And God, it's just so great. But yeah, I do think, like you said, it's they take it in a bit of a different direction. They don't really try to sound like the original. I mean, we talked about There She Goes and the ways that the different covers of that really hewed really closely to the original version. And this, they tried to kind of take it in a different direction. It's got some kind of more psychedelic tones, a bit more of like a sort of a shoegazy kind of element, which works. And I think that was the kind of thing that you would, if you want to cover that song, you need to go in a different direction with it. You need to update it for the times like that, because if you just try to sound like the Bay City Rollers, it's just not going to work. You know, they kind of captured lightning in a bottle with that one. I think it was good though. It was still good.
That's a really good point too, because that's the rub when you do a cover, I feel, because look, if you hew too close to the original, unless it's a song, again, when you're working with a song like There She Goes, like perfect in every way, like, okay, fine, stick to the original. But if you do a cover that is like too close to the original, it becomes, what was the point of even covering this? You know, but sometimes if you get a little too wild, it's like you've ruined this song. But I think you raised a good point here. The original There She Goes came out in 88, if I remember correctly. So we're talking like a 5-year difference. So like, and then with the Sixpence None the Richer version, like a decade difference, but like music had not changed that drastically in that time period. But when you're talking about the difference in time between the Bay City Rollers and this Ned's Atomic Dustbin cover, you're right. If you try to cover it exactly as it is, you're trying to mimic lightning in a bottle from a decades old song, and it's just going to sound like shit.
Yeah. Yeah. It still really hits though. More, I think it hits better in the original, but it still really works in this one. But just the S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y, the chanting, and then the bass line and the guitar coming in over the chanting, every single time it's just like, oh man, that hits really hard. It's really cool, that part.
I love his vocals in this too. Like, I really, this is a great cover. It's a really great cover.
Yeah, okay. I enjoyed it.
Okay. So up next, we've got the Darling Buds, A Long Day in the Universe, which is originally, this is one of the first one to not be a soundtrack original. This was originally on their album Erotica. And I've said before in this show plenty of times that I'm a big sucker for like airy vocals like this. And as such, I love this song. And I like with this one, a lot of times, like it's almost like dream pop vocals when they do that airy sort of vocal thing.
Kind of like My Bloody Valentine kind of.
Yes.
Cranberries-esque a little bit.
Yeah. And a lot of times it's done with like a shoegazy sort of guitars, whereas this one's not. It's a guitar line that doesn't really fit with it. It's like a 90s alt rock guitar line with it. And the harmonizing on the chorus is really pretty. I really like Andrea Lewis Jarvis's voice. That's the singer. And
she carries
a very
it.
Pretty song.
Yeah. It's a good song. And I think overall, the way it fits into the album, I think that was one thing I was, you know, revisiting it. There's a really nice mix of that very kind of American sounding alternative rock, like Toad the Wet Sprocket, mixed with that kind of late 80s sort of Britpop sound. And it's kind of a nice mix in terms of like capturing a couple of different styles within that same sort of time period. But I think there's a nice mix of all those kind of different approaches.
Well, and I think another thing too is that like this flavor of alt rock was like sort of on its way out, and the flavor of Brit rock that's in here was sort of on its way in. So that's an interesting sort of juxtaposition too. Like one was, you know, within a couple of years you had Nirvana, which had like this stuff became pretty irrelevant at that point, you know, and then it was like grunge and everything. That was the big thing. I mean, the Laws were, you know, very important to Britpop, but at the time Oasis hadn't come around yet, or Blur hadn't come around yet. So like the big years of Britpop were still a few years away. So yeah, it was sort of ahead of its time while also accidentally being like placing itself at a very specific time by having this sort of, like I said, this sort of weird American flavor of alt rock that was on its way out really at this point. Which leads us to the next song.
Oh yeah, this is the big one.
So the Spin Doctors' Two Princes, which is from their album Pocket Full of Kryptonite. I actually didn't know this. Pocket Full of Kryptonite came out in 1991, but Two Princes didn't release as a single until 1993.
It took a while for it to gain traction. I was reading about this morning as well.
Yeah, I didn't know that because I just kind of thought this song felt like it came fully formed and that album came fully formed when it came out. But I didn't realize that they kind of, and this gave me some respect for the Spin Doctors. They were kind of a like, get your, you know, roll up your sleeves and get out there and do it band. Like this album was like self-released. And then I believe it was, I don't think it was this song. I think it was Little Miss Can't Be Wrong that started getting radio play.
Yeah.
And within a couple of years, they were the biggest band. And within about 6 months, not biggest band, but real big band.
They were
massive. They were huge. And within about 6 months of that, they were like the most hated band on the planet. You know, there's a very funny, Noel and Liam Gallagher. I love those guys, even though they're both colossal pricks. And whenever I think of the Spin Doctors, I think of this interview where Noel and Liam are bemoaning grunge music, like post Kurt Cobain grunge music, like Pearl Jam and the bands that remained, and how they did not like them. And Liam is so, whatever Liam's on at that point, he's so fucked up he can barely sit up straight. He's not saying anything. He's just like wobbling side to side beside Noel. And Noel is like, Pearl Jam, bands like that, if you're so unhappy, why don't you go off yourself? And without missing a fucking beat, Liam springs to life and says, and take the Spin Doctors with you. Which is just like, I mean, people really went knives out for the Spin Doctors. Now, there's been this weird thing recently, both on this show with I Want to Sex You Up on New Jack City a couple weeks ago, and in my personal life, which involves Snow's Informer, where these songs that I thought I could go without ever hearing again have kind of sounded great in 2022 with like the benefit of time and like the loss of their ubiquity. I wouldn't quite put this song on the same level as those two, but I did like revisiting this way more than I expected to coming back to this album.
Yeah. Well, this was the song that made me want to get this soundtrack in 1995. Definitely. Like I remember hearing it in the movie and being like, oh, okay, this rocks. This is good stuff. And I not only had the soundtrack because of this song, Two Princes, actually had the Spin Doctors album as well, Pocket Full of Kryptonite, which I didn't realize as well. This is one thing I realized today was that that song, the Pocket Full of Kryptonite, is actually part of the lyrics of the song, but it's not called Pocket Full of Kryptonite. It's called Jimmy Olsen's Blues.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't realize that. But yeah, this is this was the selling point for this whole soundtrack to me. The whole reason I got it, and I, you know, absolutely loved the song. And I kind of agree. I don't think this is a song that I'm going to look back on in 2022 and say like, oh no, it's amazing. But you know, it's got good hooks. It's got some nice playing, some bluesy guitar playing, and funkiness to it. It's not surprising that it was a big hit. But on the same way, it's not surprising at all that they became so kind of polarizing, because I think that's a band, especially in retrospect, that really kind of exemplifies a very kind of annoying 90s subculture of like white guy with dreads, hacky sack, that kind of a 90s slacker figure, which I think is just, I think it's just become emblematic of that kind of very annoying caricature. But it is a good song. It's a good, great pop song, I would say.
You could probably draw a straight line, and I'm going to pull out a band that probably six people listening have heard of, but Spin Doctors, you could draw like a straight line from the Spin Doctors to like Jimmy's Chicken Shack, or like those like slacker, like white guy dread bands that came around in like the years later, but we're still kind of riding that train. You said something that I had in my notes too, is that it is easy to see why this song was huge when it came out, because it's catchy as fuck. Now I actually, Jimmy Olsen Blues that you brought up, that song actually is very clever lyrically, if you look at it. Like the idea that like it's Jimmy Olsen, you know, being being jealous of Superman. And it's a pretty clever song. But this was this and Little Miss Can't Be Wrong were, I believe, the bigger hits of the, like, they had like four singles on that first. My dad had Pocket Full of Kryptonite, by the way. But the thing about this song is it eventually came to a point when I listened to these albums like four or five times, six times or something in the lead up, like not in a row, but over the course of like, I'll take my daily walk and I'll listen to the album. And this is one that it eventually reached a point where I did skip it when it came to it, but not because it's bad. It's not, it's a good song. It's fun. But I feel like there's still a part of me that could go without hearing it very many times again. You know, I
need another 15 years and then it's going to really hit.
Yeah. I'll come back and do, I'm sure that fucking Two Princes was on at least one other soundtrack from the 90s. Oh, so absolutely. maybe if I'm still doing the show in 15 years, I'll come across one and I'll be like, 15 years ago with Rob, I was saying that.
I'm sure Little Miss Can't Be Wrong is on a soundtrack as well.
Oh God. Yeah.
It must be.
I guarantee that all three of those, cause the fourth single wasn't as big, but Jimmy Olsen Blues, Pocket Full of Kryptonite and Little Miss Can't Be Wrong are most certainly on, for whatever reason in my head, even though I know it's not the case, I feel like one of them is on the soundtrack for the Jerky Boys movie.
Yeah.
I was
gonna go ahead and say that it is.
The Jerky Boys soundtrack is actually kind of a really strange one. It's one that I want to cover on this at some point when I can find someone brave enough to watch the Jerky Boys movie for the show.
I distinctly remember the trailer to that movie that I probably had in front of a VHS that I watched countless times in the 90s, but I never saw the actual movie though.
I revisited it like a year ago, just because I was like, I'm going to watch the Jerky Boys movie, which I hadn't seen. I was a huge Jerky Boys fan back when that movie came out. Like, I thought Frank Rizzo, actually walk that back. That sounds like, I don't think I was listening to some of those early calls and they're still very funny. Like Frank Rizzo's calls are very funny still, even now, but I was a gigantic fan back then, you know, like I like had like all the cassette tapes, and at 13 or 14, whatever, when it came out, I remember thinking it was a colossally shitty movie. I actually think I enjoyed it more watching it a year ago than I did back when I was 14, but that's not saying it's good. But yeah, it's a really strange soundtrack, and we're just gonna pretend that Pocket Full of Kryptonite is somewhere on that, or Jimmy Olsen Blues. No, which one did we say was on the soundtrack? One of Us Can't Be Wrong is on the Jerky Boys soundtrack.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go.
So yeah, we'll just roll with that. So up next is Suede's My Insatiable One, which is another soundtrack original. And okay, so here's the thing about this song. It is a very, very pretty song that unfortunately, right in the middle, smack dab in the middle, in a very 90s move, just casually drops the R word. I actually had to stop and Google the lyrics because I was like, wait, what the fuck? I couldn't have heard that right. But I was forgetting that this was a song that was made in 1990. And yeah, it does. Aside from that, it's a great song. Like, I really like this one. It's just so jarring. And, you know, it was 1993. I have to assume it was 93 because it was released on their anniversary edition of their debut album, which came out in 93. But, you know, it was 1993. So you kind of chalk it up to that because it doesn't feel like in the context of the song, it's said in a mean-spirited way. But it is a great song with one really unfortunate line in it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you caught that listening to it or not.
I did not. No, no. I'm actually surprised to hear it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it is. It's a really pretty song. Like, it's a really pretty love song. But, yeah, like I said, I was like, I was walking and I'm like, I'm gonna pull my phone out and Google the lyrics to this song. No way I heard that right. I had to have heard something wrong. And I was like, nope, there it is. boy, 1993. Yeah, what a different time.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah.
but yeah, really good song. I really like this one. Okay, so number 11 is Sun 60's Maybe Baby, which is a soundtrack original. This is like the hardest band to track down on here. They have a very short Wikipedia, but their Wikipedia basically says they made three albums and split. One of their albums featured Dave Navarro. This is a very 1993-ass song, but not, again, not in a bad way. The problem with this one is it doesn't really stand out much.
It's enjoyable. Didn't do all that much for me. Just looking on YouTube Music as well right now, I think this was their most well-known song from this soundtrack.
And it's absolutely because of the soundtrack. I mean, there's no question, because Which is funny that their one soundtrack song, I'm assuming the only song they've ever had on a soundtrack, is their most famous, despite having three albums.
I did like the vocalist.
Oh, yeah. No. This isn't one that I like. It's the nicest compliment that I could give this song is it is definitely not one that I would skip.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice.
And that brings us to the closer, The Law's There She Goes, which is from their self-titled and only album. And I said that you saying near perfect song or whatever was funny because my very first note on this is exclamation point at the end. This is a perfect song.
Yeah. Like,
I mean, there's a reason it's been covered. I'm assuming that there's more than the two covers I mentioned. There's a reason it's been covered extensively over the years. And there's a reason that The Law's, despite only having one album, even though that album is really great, are still talked about 30 years later. Like The Law's are a band that like is, I mean, they were very influential. This song basically birthed Britpop, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't a huge song when it was released, but obviously it's had a huge life in the time since then, and for a good reason, but it's a perfect little song.
Yeah. As all the greatest pop songs are, it's extremely simple, and it's a testament to how much you can do in pop music with the same chords, right? It's more or less the same chord structure through the whole song. There's a couple little differentiations in the bridge part or whatever, but a really testament to the amount of what you can do in this kind of genre. A really tight, I'm just checking the time, 2:42 as well, which I think that's a central component to a really good pop song. Not only, you know, does it have great hooks, but it doesn't wear it its welcome. It's over and you kind of just want to hear it again immediately. Yeah, just as pretty much as close to pop perfection as you can possibly get. And I liked this version more than the Boo Radley's version, which was also very good. But I really liked the kind of more Beatles-y sort of production elements to this. There's a little bit more acoustic guitar. It's a little brighter, a little less of those kind of grungy, distorted tones that the Boo Radley's track gets into. Really, really great stuff. Really, really good, really good song.
Yeah, and you said repeating the same chord structure. Not only that, it just repeats the same like four lines or whatever, like the entirety of the 2 minutes and 42 seconds. There's like no, it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's like the song is the chorus, basically.
Right, yes, it is 2 minutes and 42 seconds of a chorus. That's, you nailed it.
Yeah. Which is, that's hard to do. I mean, you'd think that it would be easier for pop bands to do that more, but that's a tricky songwriting skill to pull off.
Yeah.
Make your whole song the chorus. It's like, why don't we make the whole plane out of the black box? It's the same thing. Why don't we do the whole song out of the chorus? Skip the rest of that stuff.
It's a great way to end it. Great way to end the soundtrack, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Circling back around. It's kind
of funny. There's two versions of the song on the soundtrack and in the movie. I think they play one in the beginning and I believe they play The Law's at the end, like in the closing credits, if I remember correctly. But it works still, though.
Yeah.
I want to hear it twice.
It's a weird choice, admittedly, to have the cover version and the original version on the same album, but it's such a, as I said, perfect song that I am perfectly okay with listening to two variations of it within 30 minutes or whatever long. This is a short soundtrack too. Great song, great way to end it.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do a quick wrap up here, and for the one listener who gets on me for always saying this, I cannot forget to say it. And that's the soundtrack, because apparently that's a thing I say every single episode and did not realize it until somebody pointed out that I say that every time. All right.
Nice.
So songs in the movie that were not on the soundtrack. So you've got the Bay City Rollers version of Saturday Night, Ron Ganella's A Touch of Gaelic. Now, technically, Rod Stewart gets credits for these, for You're In My Heart and Do You Think I'm Sexy. He still gets credit for, even though they're not sung by him and they're not his versions in the song. Nancy Travis doing Only You, gets a credit. Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man and Charlie Rich's The Most Beautiful Girl. So a couple songs, but I understand why they didn't make the soundtrack. Honestly, I would have taken a version of Stewart doing one of the Rod Stewart songs in the middle of the album over Mike Myers doing that poem.
Yeah. I love him doing the Bay City Rollers thing too as well.
Yes. Yeah, it's great.
His does a little dance and everything. Awesome.
Okay, so is it on Spotify? Most of it is. I guess there were less songs missing than I thought. It was only, you know what? It's only three. I was wrong. I'll take back what I said earlier. It's only missing three songs, one of which is the shitty Mike Myers song. And then it's missing Soul Asylum's The Break and Chris Whitley's Starved to Death are not on Spotify.
Yeah. So for me, because I use YouTube Music, and those songs are not on the soundtrack, but like, and also The Law's version of There She Goes is not on there, but they are on YouTube Music. Just for some reason, the links are broken on from this random 1993 soundtrack album.
Yeah, I find that on Spotify sometimes too, where people will make up, or it's mostly like, yeah, the link's broken, or somebody put the playlist together and wasn't very thorough and didn't like look to see if like the certain song was on there. Sky Half on ones that like don't show up in the soundtrack playlist, but if you look up the artist and the song, they're on there. So I should have checked on this, because I think Soul Asylum is actually on Spotify, but we're just gonna go with what I said. So Rob, let me ask you, the movie, would you consider this, if you had to rate this movie, would you consider it an essential watch? Would you say stream it if you get a chance, or would you say skip it?
I would say stream it if you get a chance. I don't think it's essential, but like we're saying, it's just a fun flick. A lot of great cameos. It's got a charm to it. It's definitely worth, like, the, it's got some very funny moments, especially with Myers playing his father, and definitely a movie that you can kind of throw on low pressure, low stakes at any time. I would definitely recommend people give this a restream. Definitely.
Okay. And I'm same here. It's an easy stream for me. I think it's a charming little movie that works both because of, and in spite of, Mike Myers. It's a really, I mean that in a bad way. You know, like I said, some of his grating things come out in this, but also some of his boyish charm is what really holds this movie together. So yeah, but absolutely stream it. So now let me ask you about the soundtrack. Would you consider this an essential soundtrack? Meaning like you need to own this. Stream it if you get a chance, skip it, or cherry pick certain songs off of it.
I would probably say to cherry pick certain songs off it. Like I said, I really loved this album as a preteen in around 94, 95 when I first picked it up. I don't think it's maybe quite as essential now as like an adult man, but some very good songs, particularly both versions of There She Goes. I would give Two Princes another spin as well. That's fun if you're hanging out with the boys, having a few beers or whatever. Throw that on. That's a great time. Everyone's gonna remember that one. So yeah, I would say maybe you can skip Rush, the New York City Club mix. You know, there's a few that I don't think are totally essential, but overall, I would definitely recommend checking out that cover of Saturday Night as well by Ned's Atomic Dustbin.
Yeah, and I said the same thing. Cherry pick, and it's mostly because really the only bad one on here is the Mike Myers track. I'm going to keep grousing about that.
I think, in all honesty though, I think you do need to listen to it to understand what the 90s were like.
That's a good point. Sometimes I do this in that context. You know what? Fuck it. I'm walking this back. I'm going to change my rating to stream it. Only, it's definitely not an essential, but I would say stream it if only to get a snapshot of 1993.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so do you think the two go well together, the music with the movie? Do you think the soundtrack fits well within the movie?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it's like as a movie and as a soundtrack, it just really captured a lot about that moment in the early 90s. And yeah, I think it works really well together. And I think like the soundtrack really helps root it in that particular moment in American history. You know, if it had been filled with 80s pop hits or 70s tracks or whatever, it wouldn't kind of resonate in that same way. But it really feels like, as a whole, the film and the soundtrack, it's like a little time capsule from that period. And if you weren't around for it, that it gives you a little sense of what was going on, I think.
And I agree. Like, it's, again, this is a very 1993 movie and soundtrack. And as such, they're like pieces of a puzzle that fit really well together. Because, as you said, it's like a snapshot, you know, of a time and a place. And for something like that, you need the type of music that you could imagine, like white coffee shop people in 1993, probably really digging. And I think all the music cues, like the times that they use There She Goes, are done really well. Even that shitty Rush 2 song works well for that montage. So yeah,
it's absolutely a great montage song.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the two go well together. Okay, so if you had to pick a top three songs on this soundtrack, what would they be? And I'm gonna make this one a little more difficult. You're not allowed to pick both versions of There She Goes. You gotta pick something that's not both versions of that.
Okay, it's still pretty easy though, because I would go with There She Goes by The Laws, Two Princes, obviously, and Saturday Night. Even though I love the Bay City Rollers version, to me, Ned's Atomic Dustbin version doesn't quite get to that level of sort of pop mastery, but still definitely worth checking out. Definitely a sort of interesting take on that classic kind of disco-y pop track. But those would be the three for sure.
we have a very similar top three. Mine is The Laws, There She Goes. The only difference here is number two with Toad the Wet Sprocket's brother. And then number three is Ned's Atomic Dustbin, Saturday Night. So that Saturday Night cover is so good. Like, listen to that. If you don't listen to anything else, because you probably, people listening to this, all know The Laws song by this point.
Yeah.
Listen to Ned's Atomic Dustbin, Saturday Night, because it is a really fun cover. So further watching, and we'll close it out here with further watching, further listening. So this is kind of a weird one because it's kind of a strange movie. So I just decided to stick with other dark comedies. So they might not necessarily be in the same vein as this, but I tie them together in certain ways. So if you want a romantic dark comedy that's sort of romantic comedy adjacent like this one, Harold and Maude, I think, is a good pairing with this. If you're looking for one that hits this one, I said hits some horror notes in the end with her being, I mean, there's about an axe murderer. Death Becomes Her is a really great dark comedy. It's so I that's like a yearly watch for me. I fucking love
Death. I haven't seen it in so long, but I would love to watch that again. It's a great Bruce Willis performance.
It's incredible. It's him. So it's so against. That was one of the ones that I was pissed didn't have a soundtrack when I was going through this, because I was like, I would love to talk about Death Becomes Her on this show because it's such a fun movie. And then the last one, if you're looking for one that sort of transcends genre and incorporates music as well as this movie does with incorporating music into the film, Phantom of the Paradise is another dark comedy that I might suggest going for with this one. So further listening, The Laws, as I said earlier, their only album is extremely good. Suede's self-titled debut is also very good. And since there's a lot of Canadian flavor to this movie, even though it's not, there's like a sort of a Canadian flavor to this movie, I feel like. Maybe I'm wrong.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's obviously the Mike Myers thing, but I would say the Godzilla episode that I did a couple weeks ago has me listening to a bunch of late 90s alt rock. So I'm gonna go with Our Lady Peace's Happiness Is Not a Fish is a very stellar album that I would throw in that doesn't really fit with the music on here, but I'm just gonna go with it anyways because it's Canadian alt rock.
Okay.
All right. So that's it. Rob, thank you so much for coming on and talking about So I Married an Axe Murderer, a movie that I had not watched in a very long time. And it made me realize some hard truths going back and watching it. Mike Myers is still a very funny guy when he's on. And
yeah,
perhaps we've been a little too hard on him. Even though I was kind of hard on him in this episode, I don't think that he deserves all of the scorn that he's received over the years.
No, and some of it might be self-inflicted. Like maybe perhaps he did lean too much into the sort of wacky character stuff because he knew that was what was bringing in the box office bucks, and like we said earlier, he never really took the opportunity to expand his horizons in any way and kind of pigeonholed himself in that. And then, you know, as this culture kind of passed him by, he found himself not really being able to keep up with it.
Yeah, I think that's, and I think also that, and you got to look at stories of his ego, the bruised ego that came with having a couple of box office flops, I think is another thing that played into that, because he pretty much just vanished. Okay. Well, Rob, let everyone know where they can find you on, you know, podcasts, Twitch, your socials, and I will put all of this in the episode description as well, but let everyone know where they can find you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just wanted to say thank you, Eric, for the invite. I appreciate it. And like, in all honesty, you know, I recommended that we talk about this movie and it was coming up and I was kind of starting to dread it because I was like, I'm not going to be able to talk for an hour and a half about the fucking So I Married an Axe Murderer soundtrack. What was I thinking with this? But we're now, you know, an hour and 90 minutes into this thing and it's been a breeze. It's been an absolute delight to revisit this and to talk about it with you. So I appreciate it a lot. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Rousseau. I'm every single day streaming on Twitch. I do the Rob Rousseau show on twitch.tv/Rob Rousseau every single day, starting at noon Eastern. I also do a podcast with my colleague, Jordan Yule, called The Insurgents. You can find that on theinsurgents.substack.com.
All right. And Rob, thank you for the compliment. I appreciate that. I'm glad that this was like an easy conversation. If you were dreading, I've had that where I've been on shows before too, where I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to talk about this for like 90 minutes, but this is a breezy, fun talk and I'm glad that you came on. I really am happy to have you on here.
Yeah, so, me too.
All right. Well, Rob, I hope you have a tremendous night and everyone listening at home, I hope you all have a tremendous weekend.
Bye.
Ain't no use running. Ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you, and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original songs,